Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. Take the guesswork out of landscaping with our free, easy-to-use design program. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape blocks at the best prices. Get started on your dream landscape now. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Hello and welcome to the weekend podcast of Lotus Eaters. I'm here with Josh and
Hello.
Today we're going to be talking about how to make better decisions. And before we start, I just want to tell everyone that from next week on, we're going to be moving on to another branding. We're going to have a new name for the weekend show, and we don't know yet what the name is going to be exactly, but it's going to be something else than the weekend podcast. And so for the viewers on YouTube, you will be able to find us on the other channel, which you can find here or here in the description as well, which is the channel is just called The Lotus Eaters and not the podcast of Lotus Eaters. So you'll be able to find us there. We're not going to be on this channel anymore. Of course, you can still find us at lotuseaters.com anytime. We have all our content there, premium content, free content, podcast, everything. So with that out of the way, we can delve into it.
All right. So I thought about doing a particularly nourishing podcast today where it's not necessarily political, and I was just focused on doing something where you can actually build upon yourself and feel like you've got something out of it at the end, not feeling angry at how awfully the world is going. So this podcast is based on the idea that people are prone to a whole host of decision-making biases that mean that they approach their decisions somewhat irrationally. And the idea is that if you approach your decisions more rationally, then you will have better outcomes overall, because these biases limit you in pursuing what would otherwise be your end goals, as I see it. And my kind of justification for doing this is that I think that decisions encompass a large amount of people's daily lives, and there's something essential in your daily life which you don't really pay that much attention to, the actual nature of how you come to a decision. Therefore, in considering this, hopefully it can help you come to better ones, which will have an improving effect on your life, hopefully. A bit ambitious, but...
Right. And so what kind of biases are we going to talk about? Like we're going to talk about how to overcome biases a bit later, but what are some of the biases then?
So I've gone through a whole host of cognitive biases, and I've picked out perhaps the most relevant and interesting ones. And the first one we're going to talk about in this part is confirmation bias, which is one that probably many people are familiar with, or at least the one that most people will be familiar with out of all of them. It's kind of an example to get your head around, because it's not necessarily a difficult one to understand. And I'm hoping that once people are made aware of these things, that they can help mitigate against them. But I'll describe the strategy of doing so in a second. So I want to say that I agree with the view of bounded rationality, which was proposed by Herbert Simon, where individuals who make decisions are limited by the difficulty of the decision problems themselves, as well as the cognitive limitations of their mind and all of the assumptions, values, and everything that is subjective that they bring to the table in a decision. And there's also the limitation of time that people dedicate to coming to a decision, which is actually a huge limiting factor in it. And decision makers, in the view of this theory, act as something known as satisficers. So they sacrifice certain criteria just to meet a certain satisfactory base level, rather than seeking to choose options which objectively maximize their supposed goals, if that makes any sense.
So is that something along the lines of you have something that you want to achieve and you have kind of the best outcome possible,
yeah.
but that best outcome possible is not something that you're going to go after because there's costs on the other side as well, and kind of doing the whole rational analysis of everything and mm-hmm. figuring out what the outcomes might be and what the consequences might be of everything is quite costly, like in time yeah. and with your effort and everything like that. So in order to kind of make these decisions, you're not actually comparing, you're not actually taking into account the best possible scenario, but mm-hmm. kind of the baseline scenario of what you can achieve with the given time investment you mm-hmm. can make, right?
The example I like to make is that when you go shopping on a high street, which you might have to imagine back quite long ago now, but
a hypothetical situation. is a high street?
Yeah. In this scenario, you don't go looking in every single possible shop for the item that you're looking for. You kind of find something that you're relatively happy with and you buy it. You don't look at every single option because it's just too tedious. You have a minimum threshold, which mm-hmm. you say, okay, something has to meet this imagined criteria for me to be happy with it. And right. then that should be enough. People don't necessarily go looking forever to maximize their opportunities because, of course, there is a cost yeah. of their time.
So let's look at that a bit closer, though. So you said that they don't behave completely rationally because of these kind of constraints and these things,
yeah.
right? And so how do you define rationality in this way? Because if you're saying people don't want to spend a lot of their time and effort on making only marginal changes to their outcomes, mm-hmm. that sounds like an irrational analysis, even though it's not made consciously, right? It's something that you don't want to spend a lot of time and effort on something that will bring you only an incremental change mm-hmm. if the gist of what you already wanted is achieved by a much lower amount of effort.
Sure. So it's not necessarily to say that people who make decisions quickly and don't put much care into it are necessarily doing it in a way that is bad. Some decisions that make sense to, like what kind of cereal to have for breakfast.
Sure.
Like, who cares? It's not that important. And that decision...
That's a controversial thing to say.
Like, well, I mean, it's important a little bit, but, you know, it's... Whether you have one or the other, it doesn't really matter. And if you spend like hours and hours thinking, what is the best breakfast cereal I can have? You're just wasting your time. So in that sense, yeah. But people take these biases to places where they actually want to consider things mm-hmm. in a way that is very reasoned and rational. And it's not necessarily useful there to dedicate less time. So although there are decisions that you need to sit down and really consider, obviously there are lots of small decisions that aren't very important. Mm-hmm. And although these biases affect both, I can certainly understand that not dedicating enough time to the smaller, less important things is perfectly reasonable, and I do it all the time. So
might that be something like interpersonal differences between different kind of priorities, because what might be inconsequential to you and me or something like that. Mm-hmm. So like picking different kind of cereal, like slightly different or something like that, might be something inconsequential to us, but maybe quite important to someone else. And also looking at something that we find important that we would spend a lot of time and effort on. Some of the people might find that not as important, and so they just rather do that the fast way, the easiest way.
Well, coming to a decision means you have to evaluate the value of each option, and it depends on how much value you place on it, which depends on how much time you're willing to dedicate mm. and how long you're willing to think about it.
I think what I was more for commenting on mm-hmm. was you saying that some things are important enough so that people should probably spend more time on them rather than just like resorting to it faster and in a biased way, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's those down things... to mm-hmm. their own interpretation. Like, importance and value are subjective things, and it's up to the individual to establish what's important to them. And I'm not trying to say what's important and what isn't. I'm just trying to say, if you're coming to these decisions, here's some things to watch out for. I'm not telling you what to think or what to do. I'm just saying.
Right. That makes sense.
Here's some things to watch out for if you want to make your own decisions and make your own way in life. I don't want to be telling people what to do.
I guess I was interested in getting closer into what the idea of rationality is and what is rational, wasn't it isn't. But I'm sure we can get back to it in the end if we don't answer that question.
Sure.
throughout the piece.
The word rationality is basically trying to get to the gist of you have this desired option that maximizes your utility, to use economic term. You're seeking to achieve your goals as well as you can, and that's what it means in decision making to be rational.
Okay.
That answers your question.
So okay, I mean we can get back to it in the end when we've gone over the examples and kind of research. So you've actually done your own research in that, right?
I have indeed. So when I was doing my master's degree, I did a very large study which I built up from the ground up into decisions people make for others and how they differ from the actual decisions they make for themselves, even if the scenario is identical. And I theorized that this could be due to differences in how they perceive the situation between each instance, because although the situation is objectively exactly the same, they perceive the values of the different factors differently. So this kind of perceptual focused difference comes from something known as construal level theory, which is just the level at which someone construes a situation. So if something's closer to them, known as the psychological distance, then they think in terms that are a bit more pragmatic and focused on actually getting things done, whereas the more distance there is, the more they move towards this kind of idealistic view where they're saying, well, just follow your dreams, this sort of thinking, whereas perhaps someone who was going through that situation themselves would be like, well, I've got to save up money to pay my rent. I don't want to follow my dreams.
and so those different levels, that's this kind of scale off. On one end, the kind of rational, or I don't want to use that word, but kind of like personality of the decision and the kind of on the ground decision making. And on the other end of the scale would be the kind of idealistic, not really related to what's going on right now. Like that would be the scale on.
Yeah, and I'm not necessarily suggesting one or the other is better per se. It's just this is the spectrum of the difference that we have observed in research, and my research found that there was about a 2% difference between people thinking pragmatically when they decided for themselves and idealistically when they were deciding for someone else or advising someone else, which I see as functionally the same, because the psychological distance will be the same. Therefore, the way they perceive the situation is the same. So whether they're deciding for someone else or advising someone else, it shouldn't really matter.
I'm just playing the devil's advocate here, but wouldn't it be possible that they're not the same things, because when someone is advising someone else, they know that the other person doesn't have to take their advice and act on it. They can take different kinds of advice and kind of and put them together before deciding. And so you can be more kind of bolder or more forward in your recommendations of what people should do if you're not actually doing it for them. But that they can still decide whether to take it whole or in part or in combination with some other advice.
It might slide it further along in the kind of scale, perhaps, but the underlying mechanism psychologically is the same, which was what I was concerned about in the actual research itself. And because it was a novel piece of research, no one had actually looked at this before, I felt like I had to stick to the fundamentals and not try and be too ambitious with it, because
fair enough.
although there is a view of science as being defined by paradigms, a lot of scientific research that doesn't perhaps get the spotlight in the public is the science which builds very incrementally and slowly on previous research, and it's gradual, slow progress, but it's more reliable, and it's generally viewed as better science than just we've come up with this wild new theory. That's not actually not that productive, because then there's a whole host of other work that you've got to do alongside that. But that's a tangent.
And so if you said you found a 2% difference, about 2% difference.
Yeah.
And so what does that mean? How did you measure that? Or what was it? What was it in? Like 2% of money of kind of what?
So I designed an experiment where it was looking at university choices, and I picked out three different factors which would play on either pragmatic or idealistic decisions. And I had these three factors which would alternate in numerical value between the two different options, starting from high to low, and it exhausted all of the kind of spectrum of possible combinations in these three factors. And then I did statistical analysis to test the statistical significance, to see the probability that the patterns I observed were by chance, and they held up under most analysis. So I think the statistical analysis showed that there was like a 0.01% chance that it was just
chance.
Yeah. So I felt I was pretty happy with that. But moving on to why it's actually important to talk about these decision-making kind of biases, is it's kind of presumed that people want to move as close to their goals, and these biases limit people. And considering the number of decisions you make every day, having some kind of predisposition to a certain bias could inadvertently have a significant impact on your life, despite you perhaps not even being aware of it, because these things are relatively universal. So if everyone's thinking in these certain ways, then it may not necessarily jump out at you that this is happening.
So now we get into the part where we tell everyone how to overcome their biases.
Yeah, and it's not as complicated as you might think. I just anecdotally from my own experiences, just being aware of the pitfalls helps somewhat in being able to give certain patterns of thought a name and be able to point to them and say, listen, this way of thinking can lead to bad decisions, and this is what it's called. And once you can point to it, you can say, okay, I can avoid that. But when it's kind of abstract and intangible, it's very difficult to understand your own thoughts in this way. So once you give something a name, say, this is what it looks like, it's much easier to recognize it, obviously, and then mitigate against it. So all of these biases are conscious biases, they're not unconscious. So you are aware of them, you can take action to prevent them.
Right. So it's something that you might do unconsciously until you actually realize that you're doing it, and then you can see it perfectly well and you can take actions against it, right?
Yeah.
Something like that.
And I've got an example from dual process theory just to show how a different approach could improve your decision making. So in dual process theory, it's proposed that there are two different systems in your brain which come to decisions, and although they don't really define, it's not necessarily important. The concept is the key thing here, because there is some criticism that they make out these two systems as being too discrete, but it's not the purpose here. The purpose is to characterize two different ways of thinking which are opposed to one another, and I feel like one is superior to the other. So the first one is kind of an unconscious, automatic, quick, low effort, and easily influenced by emotions. It's kind of your unconscious decision-making processes, although it can still be somewhat within your awareness. So it comes to decisions based on associations and rules, and it's typically less rational because of how it comes to these decisions. So it's just quick and fast rules that are automatic and almost emotive in your reaction. And I would argue that this is not as good as this second system, which operates on a conscious and deliberate, slow, and it's kind of high effort. You've got to deliberately sit down and think about something, and it's largely detached from your emotions, which can influence your decisions. So this system comes to decisions based on implications. So it's looking at cause and effect rather than just associations. And it's typically more objective and fact-based, but that's like a generalization. Your first system can still come to perfectly reasonable decisions. The example I like to use is like the fear response. It's rational to be fearful of certain stimuli, because the cost of not being fearful of certain stimuli could cost you your life, whereas the cost of running away from something like as a false alarm costs you only a bit of embarrassment and pride. So weighing that up, it makes sense to have this decision-making bias.
So I want to challenge you a little bit on the idea in which you said that one is superior to the other, because one is kind of more suitable for us to use than the other, because from what I've heard from you, one of those involves kind of decisions of high quality, of more granularity of the result. Mm-hmm. So you can discriminate better between different things and not kind of do that by association, lump them together if they don't belong together. But that kind of second system two, that costs a lot of resources, right? Resources in your brain. It costs a lot of time, a lot of effort. You said it's slow, it's high effort, detached from emotions, conscious. Mm-hmm. That's all a lot of effort that you need to expend.
Well,
it seems to me like if you're gonna decide, quote unquote, which one you'd like to use in any situation, what you need to do is kind of weigh those costs and benefits of each, right?
Sure.
And so it's not like one is superior to the other. That's only the case if you forget about the costs that they mm-hmm. also have, right?
Well, I see it as I agree with the general gist of your point that some are more appropriate for certain decisions than others. If you're making really trivial decisions, it doesn't pay to sit down and really think about them, as we said earlier. But I feel like the second slow and conscious and deliberate system can help shape the first more automatic system, in that in taking a slow and considered approach to something, you may be able to establish a new rule in which the more unconscious automatic system can operate on. It's not necessarily a two divorced concepts. They have influence over one another, because the areas in your brain that are responsible for decisions, although it's spread across a disparate group of brain areas, then there's more overlap than there is difference, so that they can influence one another in a way. So the way I see it is, you can sit down and slowly work out these new decision-making rules that you want to abide by, and therefore you can refine the more unconscious system and come to quicker, better decisions through that method than perhaps otherwise.
So could we, like, if we want to bring that to today's culture or something like that, to what's mm-hmm. going on, is it something along the lines of what kind of the people who really are focused on discrimination, racism, and things like that, they're talking about the like unconscious racism and unconscious biases like that, mm-hmm. and so is am I interpreting it correctly that their aim would be to kind of consciously go through these biases through these kind of quick reactions that you might have in some situations, mm-hmm. and to kind of remove them because they're not really justified to have
these. Just to clarify, it's that they're not entirely unconscious, as in you can come to a quick decision and still be aware of it. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily that it was entirely unconscious. Perhaps the unconscious mind shapes things a little bit, but in this sense, you don't need to need to rely on anything that is beyond your own awareness. And that's what I'm talking about. This is all kind of above the unconscious mind, mm-hmm. because if you're unconscious of something, you're not going to be able to change it. So it'd be futile to try.
No, fair enough. I think what I meant more was something like hypothetical situation. Someone goes down the road, you know, and like and that like it's not exactly nice, you know. The surroundings are kind of like weird, and they see people of color, a person of color, and they kind of cross the road because they're afraid of them, because they have, you know, it's kind of half unconscious association with like people of color being violent or something like that. And so that's what would be called in this kind of space the unconscious bias of unconscious racism, right? And so would it be fair to say that this is like one of the area that some people want kind of society to progress in, this way to make yourself do these snap decisions in a different way than with these kind of ingrained ideas of different races?
I think you're perhaps giving them a bit too much credit there. That they don't make that distinction necessarily. They just say, well, it's either conscious or unconscious. They kind of feel like they've got most of the conscious out of the way, and the unconscious is the main barrier. They don't necessarily break up the conscious decisions into two parts. They just separate it that way. And of course, unconscious bias training doesn't work. And I have a very good piece on lotuseaters.com, which breaks it down. And I also covered it in one of the previous weekend podcasts as well. And it actually plays into confirmation bias as well, which I would like to get into.
Okay.
Because there are some sub-biases, if that's a term. I think I've just made it up. Of confirmation bias, which tie in nicely to this unconscious bias training and diversity training, but I don't want to spoil it, and I'll get into confirmation bias. So confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, interpret, and focus on and remember information in a way that confirms your own preconceptions about the world. So being greeted with new information doesn't necessarily change people's mind where otherwise it should, if that makes sense. And I'd like to have a quick look at a study which is called Motivated Numeracy and Enlightened Self-Government, which is a very sinister title for something that's very innocuous. So they found that confirmation bias affects how people look at statistics, which I think statistics are one of the best ways we can look at issues of politics in a more objective, less subjective way, which is more reflective of reality than our own reported experiences. So I feel like this is particularly egregious, that there's a bias here in how people view statistics. And
I mean, statistics can be easily manipulated.
Of course.
Not just the data, but the what you do with statistics. Like you can cook any statistics into anything you want.
Mm-hmm. But a tool is not the bad thing, it's the people using them, of course.
Sure, but I mean, if you people are aware of this, that statistics can be misused, so it can make sense that people are skeptical of the statistics that they don't like, because they would think, okay, like someone obviously manipulated the statistics in a way that, like, to tell a story that's not true.
Let's pretend, just for the sake of this though, that all the statistics are fine. They live in a world where there's no controversy around this, and they can trust the statistics they're given. Even if they are trustworthy, these biases still play out. That's the crux of what I'm trying to bring attention to. So the scientists gave these participants difficult problems which kind of activated their ability to draw valid causal inferences from empirical data. And in the first part, they gave them a task to look at statistics which represented treatments for a skin rash. So it's relatively uncontroversial. And they found that subjects who were highest in numeracy did substantially better than the less numerate ones in avoiding confirmation bias, if that makes any sense. So they understood the weight which the statistics held, and they applied them more effectively than people who were less numerate.
So that this study wasn't about showing what confirmation bias is or that it exists.
No,
it was about saying how can you avoid it, right?
Mm-hmm. I think we all know that confirmation bias exists, and we don't necessarily need to go over the research because we can figure it out anecdotally, but there is a huge wealth of research on it and it's very well documented, not disputed, different fields.
So what is actually important about confirmation bias is to know how to overcome that, and that's what this is about, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So
one of the ways is kind of having like numeracy skills and being able to kind of...
It's a little bit more complicated than that, actually.
Okay.
It's so they ran the experiment again with the same exact data, except they proposed it to the participants that it was the results of a study into a gun control ban, and I think they were Americans, so this is a kind of important issue in America at the minute, as many Americans I'm sure are more than aware. And they found that the polarization increased with numeracy. So people who are more numerate gave more polarized answers, which is very counterintuitive because you would think, well, if they are more competent, then they would give a far more neutral answer or something that's more reasonable, at least, if you get what I'm trying to say.
I think I do. Is that something, what I said before, is that people who know how to work with data and who know how these things operate, is it possible that these people are also more aware of how you can manipulate data, and that's what is showing here?
It could potentially be.
If they have a strong emotional interest in the outcome, and they also know, they are aware of the possibility of the statistics being kind of not very honest. Then they would put these things together and say, okay, I'm definitely not going to trust this, and I have good reasons not to, because I didn't know where this guy came from, right?
That could certainly be the motivation for people becoming more polarized, although the experimenters didn't necessarily look at the motivation to go towards that. They just sought to explain the behavior in a very kind of... cold and psychological way that we often do. So they explain the behavior with something known as the identity protective cognitive thesis, which treats cultural conflict as disabling the faculties that members of the public use to make sense of decision relevant science.
Okay, so they said that because they were emotionally invested in it, they didn't use the skills that they had.
Yeah, that's what they're trying to say, that more numerate subjects would use their quantitative reasoning capacity to selectively conform to the interpretation of the data that they most identified with politically, rather than applying their capacity.
Right, so this kind of interpretation of the results is something like very different to what I said before. That would not be like in line with what I said. Like both would be the possibilities, right, or something like that. The authors of this study draw this conclusion, but is it something that they followed up on, or?
Well, I don't know whether they followed up on this particular example, but research in this area seems to suggest that when something becomes more emotive, It activates different reasoning capacities in your in your brain, and the emotiveness can override your critical thinking skills. So that's what they're getting at. It's like a very psychological understanding of it. I mean, it's certainly possible that they're mistaken and it could be another thing. But the kind of warning that they're trying to provide is still applicable, in that they're saying that when you're greeted with something that's very emotive and you feel like you've got your identity on the line, the tendency is to perhaps be less reasonable than you could otherwise be, because you want to save face.
Right.
And it might not even be a deliberate thing. It might just be, right, this is annoying. These statistics are saying that there should be more gun control, whereas I don't believe that. And therefore I'm going to try and interpret them in a way that they might not like. and therefore they're coming to this decision which might be very different had they come to it with a neutral frame of mind.
Right. Yep. No, fair enough. That's I think there might be a lot of different situations in which you could, if you kind of apply this conclusion, and where I think it's quite, it sounds quite reasonable enough that I would expect that other studies would show this to be the case in other situations, not necessarily ones that you could also interpret in other ways, such as the one that I said. But so I think that sounds like something that could be true, and also you said that it works well with other findings in psychology, so that makes sense.
I think I picked it out because it was a particularly controversial and interesting thing, rather than it necessarily being the best embodiment of what I wanted to say. And I want to also talk about another aspect of confirmation bias, which is known as the backfire effect, which is a reaction to disconfirming evidence, which actually goes to strengthen one's previous beliefs, which ties in nicely to the findings of that previous experiment. And I think a good example of this is the UK government's research into unconscious bias training and diversity training. So I'm very happy that my tax money has gone towards this, by the way. So they are saying that perhaps giving people this information in unconscious bias training makes these things more available. Like, by talking about racist stereotypes, they're more active in your mind, and therefore if you have these racist stereotypes more readily in your head, then they might emerge more. And that's what they're proposing happens in these kind of woke training sessions, that there is an observable backfire effect. We've kind of looked at the data, and it seems like sometimes it actually has the opposite effect of making people more prejudiced rather than less. And this backfire effect is the proposed psychological mechanism in which this occurs. And
I'm thinking about two things that this could, the reasons for this, right? And one of them could be the backfire effect of like seeing data for something and that strengthening your belief in the opposite.
Sure.
But also it could be that these trainings are conducted in such a way that it puts people off, right? And people actually, because you're dealing with people and with social situations, so people could be put in a situation where they feel uncomfortable, where they don't feel like they're learning anything, but they're just being told off and something like that. And so they could come to a conclusion that even like less consciously, that they didn't really like it. This whole thing was bad, you know. I didn't learn anything from it, and so therefore I'm gonna be emboldened in what I thought before, because I'm convinced that was the good approach or something like
that's actually more or less what they said in the report as well. This is only one aspect of many factors. Like, human psychology is very complex, and isolating one factor doesn't mean it necessarily causes everything else. It can just contribute to a prevailing trend. And they did find that people who were compelled to go to this training resented going because they'd been forced, and they were like, well, I'm not racist, why are you making me go to this training? And they reportedly held it against either the women or the ethnic minorities in the company. And the backfire effect was actually found in the hiring numbers of people as well, in that after they'd gone to this training, some companies actually hired less rather than more from these protected groups that were trying to, the training was trying to unbias people against.
So what I'm thinking about is whether there are two kinds of backfire effects, right? One psychological and the other one policy related, right? And the one that we've been talking about is the policy related, and then the one that is psychological, like more purely psychological, let's say, would be the one where you actually, like, you're convinced of something and you see actual data or statistics that say the opposite, and you say, like, okay, no, I'm definitely not going to believe this. I'm going to believe more what I thought before, right?
Yeah.
Isolated from like a mm-hmm. or unrelated to a social situation where there can be different influences and different explanations for why is going on. Where, for example, you're not forced to do anything, which by itself can breed resentment. Right?
Sure.
So and I think there are the two things that are called backfire effect that we're kind of putting together, or maybe not. I don't know.
I mean, it's certainly possible. We've certainly not got conclusive research yet to isolate every aspect of it and explain it in its entirety. We have enough to know that it exists and can identify it in some certain areas, but as with a lot of the psychological sciences, it's relatively young compared to many mm-hmm. other sciences, so we don't have as many conclusive answers to things as perhaps we might like, but we can at least point to these things and say, hey, these things, we know they occur. Here are some explanations that we feel are most likely, but perhaps they're wrong. Like, it's never, in psychology, you never propose things as like an ultimatum. It is either true or it's not, because you can never know for certain because of just the sheer complexity of the human brain. You can't say things categorically, yes or no.
Right. What I was thinking about was just whether it's... whether we're partly getting into the concept of unintended consequences, right? Mm-hmm. In policy or in economics, whatever. Because, like, okay, you institute minimum wage, then you force people to fire people who don't kind of who are employed below the minimum wage, largely because those businesses might not be so profitable as to offer those people the minimum wages that you just instituted. So the policy that is aimed at, or ostensibly aimed at, helping those kind of poorer, less earning workers end up hurting them more. And so if that's an unintended consequence of the policy. But I feel like that's the backfire effect that we've talked about with the unconscious bias training, could be something like that, right? So you want it to have a certain effect, but it has a different effect, not because mm-hmm. of people's psychological workings in mm-hmm. their heads, but because of how the policy works and how it's designed and what it produces in real life, as opposed to mm-hmm. on paper.
So that's like extrapolating the psychological component and applying it to the decision-making processes of social policy, isn't
right.
it?
Right, yeah.
So I don't necessarily think the same psychological components are at play there, but it's the same principles at a more abstract mm-hmm. level.
Yeah, but that's what I meant. Mm-hmm. I don't think that those are the same things either, but that's why I thought those are kind of two separate things. And
yeah, like
call them like both the backfire mm-hmm. effect, even though it's kind of analogical in a sense, but not completely.
I think the term backfire effect has connotations in multiple fields mm-hmm. that are slightly different from one another, as with many different kinds of terminology. In psychology, it's purely focused on the beliefs that people hold and how they shape people's future decisions. So it's more in that sense than rather the cause and effect of a certain policy, if that makes any sense.
Okay, so what's the Semmelweis reflex?
So it's a tendency to reject new evidence that contradicts a paradigm. So paradigm is just the prevailing view, and anything that questions a prevailing view has a tendency to be rejected just because this is the accepted norm. And
so would they be very close to the confirmation bias as it is?
It's
like an application of it on a social level of what is kind of
A different component. It's like almost like a normalcy bias. That's another bias in and of itself. Mm-hmm. But it's kind of a movement towards the prevailing norm, purely because it's the norm rather than based on it being necessarily the most convincing argument.
You think that occurs because people find it easier socially to be kind of in the conforming position, because it makes your relationships easier. It requires less effort for you to navigate society if you mm-hmm. if you don't question those things.
I think that's certainly a part of it, but I think from my kind of view, it's if the majority are wrong about something, doesn't that set a disturbing view of wider society, that people can hold widespread beliefs about something that could be wrong? And confronting this idea is perhaps more difficult to people, that the majority of people could be wrong and that they could be right, but they're in a small minority. And it makes them feel powerless and like the world is going on a trajectory that is bad, and people don't like to feel that way and might shape their own beliefs to kind of appeal more towards the median outcome rather than based purely on the evidence that they're looking at.
I just remembered one thing. One study I saw, it's quite famous and older. It's about people were given these kind of sticks. I don't know if on screen or in real life, and they were told to decide which one is short and which one is longer, or whether they're the same length.
And I think I know this study.
And there's they had a lot of imposters in that kind of room where with the participants.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah,
so all the imposters were like, were looking at the shorter stick, and they were like, oh, this is definitely longer than the longer one, right? And all of them said that, and we're really quite sure about it. And then the participants were like, I don't know, like I can see that this is shorter, but I didn't, like these people are all saying this is longer, it might be longer. I'm not the one that's wrong with when it's all of them that are saying the same thing, right?
Yeah,
and so a lot of them actually said that the shorter one is longer, just because a lot of other people said it, and that must mean I'm wrong, because my perception is obviously imperfect, and so if a lot of people are saying it, that must be true.
Yeah, this is research into social conformity, which I think Solomon Ash was one of the key experiments where he had lines on a screen, and people were he had some stooges, which are just people collaborating with the experimenter unbeknownst to the participants, the legitimate participants in the experiment, who were saying that some of the shorter lines were actually longer, and then they were seeing whether the legitimate participants would agree. And they had several of these stooges and one actual participant. So
do you remember the numbers and results?
Not off the top of my head, there was a significant amount of conformity, but it was also conducted in, I think it was 1936 off the top of my head.
Oh, okay.
So it was a really long time ago. Yeah. And I think we have moved to more of an individualistic society, and people are less prone to conform. And that's to do with something which is known as locus of control, how we view ourselves is influencing the world around us, and people have moved less towards external influences. But that's a huge tangent.
No, but that's good, because that brings us kind of together to the end of this was about biases and about how to how they manifest and what people kind of can observe, what can be observed in people. And so we wanted to kind of say what people can do against those biases, or how to avoid them, right? So how would you kind of distill the kind of main point of those things that you talked about? Like what can they do? How to make sure that they can avoid those biases?
Well, just make sure you're aware of these common pitfalls, being aware of them, where they're relevant, what they're called, how they manifest is probably the most important, because then you can identify and avoid them, but also making sure to spend more time on your decisions to make sure you're using that more rational part of your brain, for want of a better way of putting it, or the part of your brain which considers things more in their entirety.
All right. Well, that's, sounds good. Well, so we'll be back tomorrow and continuing the discussion about biases and about what people can do about them. And so I'm just going to remind everyone that from next week on, we're going to be making this show under a different name. We don't know what the name is going to be yet, but on YouTube, for the viewers on YouTube, it's going to be on the other channel, not the podcast of the Lotus Eaters, but just the Lotus Eaters. So if you want to follow us there, it would be great, because we're not going to be on this channel anymore with the weekend show. So you can find us there. Link is in the description or up there somewhere. And let's see you tomorrow.
Thanks for watching.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day Sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.